welcome to the latest episode, the first episode in a long time of the Elaborate Podcast. Joining me as ever in studio is Maria. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
That's great to hear. Well, you might be familiar with this podcast. We have listeners all over the world, and we usually just improvise and talk about cultural things happening in and outside Madrid. If that sounds familiar, you probably heard that in the intro. But in this revamped podcast, we'll have a couple of diversions here and there with interviews and things like that. But the main focus of our podcast now will be literary reportage, which is to say, reporting in a literary way. And this week's episode, which is kind of relaunching our show, focuses on very specific themes, doesn't it, Maria?
It does.
And what would those themes be?
Well, it focuses mainly on migration and the sense of place and moving to a place and missing a place and just the whole thing that goes with arrivals, departures, and everything in between.
Like, you've read a book about migrations published by Penguin, which is essentially an anthology of migrant stories, is that correct?
Yes, it talks about stories, well, it's extracts from different books and different stories talking about people leaving their countries and the experience of the trip and the experience of arriving, you know, on a different place and just kind of staying there and how it feels through the years onto like a old age and how it affects your relationship with your children and so on. And how different generations experience in a different way. But the most interesting thing is that it has extras of books from like the 18th century even, I believe, till now.
Fascinating. And also a friend of the podcast, Joseph Roth, will be making an appearance. We reference two of his books. And also Trevor Noah's autobiography, which talks about, well, displacements, geographical markers. You know, I'm from this part of the town, you're from this part of the town. And his story feeds into, well, what you've mentioned about your book, Joseph Roth as well. Some reflections of some neighborhoods in Madrid, and also a book about Spanish refugees in the Civil War, many of whom went to France. And again, we're leaning heavily towards and leaning heavily on kind of nature and place. And place is not just an abstract concept, it's, you know, a living, breathing entity that we interact with on an everyday basis, and nature looms large one way or another in all of these stories as well. So without further ado, we'll have our musical break here and we'll go into, well, our new format. Hopefully you enjoy it. And we'll be back, of course, as always, with another episode focusing on other themes and other books that have really interested us in the last few months. When the second wave took hold, they didn't put the city on lockdown. Staring into the existential abyss of another paralysis, we blinked. It wasn't the barrio we went for, It was the health centers. And when the news came, there were sighs, resignation, and Google searches. What is a health center, anyway? And on what side of the line do we fall? Restricted or unrestricted? After all, a neighborhood can change within generations. Didn't Leonardo DiCaprio quote Nathaniel Hawthorne in The Departed by saying that families in America are always rising and falling? We might know Hawthorne as well as he does, but we know that his character, Billy Costigan, knows what it means and what it takes to be upwardly mobile, how rich and poor blocks can coexist and, more often than not, trade places. Despite all this flux, a barrio is a place with an edge, an angle, and something that says unequivocally, this is what I am. Even when it's otherworldly, it speaks of and to something, and to someone. Joseph Roth's Job sees an old Jewish family place themselves in America, and he captures beautifully the madness and wonder of what stepping into a new world and the new world must have felt like for people through generations. In what he saw neighborhoods, even though he, like his public, were dispersed. He was spread by the fracturing of his homeland, by poverty, alcoholism, and the rising tide of Nazism. He owned nothing, not even the books that he wrote. Yet through him, we know of boers dominating barbershops, thrilling circuses, modern department stores, subway ennui, and the anonymous dead lining the walls of the police station. He wrote the story that was on every corner, and with him, you know the best bars on the block, and how the gangsters break into your home. The itinerant Roth was obsessed with comings and goings. The skyscrapers went up, making Icarus redundant but giving gainful employment to serious men and women in heels. The bohemian bar pulled people in, and most of them were hangers-on and posers, whose best performances were realised by saying they would never drink there again. But getting a lucky commission does need a toast. In the park beyond the brewery belt, wardens are like lighthouse keepers, and sand is shifted back and forth. A barrio is of waves lapping in on themselves, and it's a hive of people shrouded in their own personal worlds. The bars of Lava PS have opened their doors to hippies, hipsters, and artists, to Africans, Indians, and Irish. In much the same way, the city of Madrid has long opened its metaphorical ones. All are welcome to this working-class barrio, or neighbourhood, just south of the city centre, and all are welcome to Madrid. Nobody in the Spanish capital, you see, is actually from Madrid, and the city of brown plateaus acts as a sponge, soaking up travellers, immigrants, and people. The name literally means wash feet, and what it lacks in the English translation it gives back by offering a hint of the neighbourhood's past. A fountain in the old plaza used to administer the old Mary Magdalene treatment to believers, and the presence of Calle de la Fe reinforces the Catholic facets of the barrio. Historically, left-leaning politics have found a home in the tall, uniform apartment blocks, which sees its modern manifestation in the Republican stalls of the nearby plaza of Tirso de Molina, which is situated on the site of an old monastery. La Tabacalera is one of the highlights of Lava PS. A former tobacco factory, this cavernous building, populated with darkened alcoves and wide hallways, lay dormant until 2002. Since that date, it has been home to documentary premieres, arts, and workshops. What elevates it even further is that anyone, and that means anyone, can reserve the space for their event. It makes realizing an artistic dream tangible. And so, if your version of traveling means living in Madrid for a short period of time, why not give voice to your tourist eyes with your very own exhibition or theatre performance? Or get involved with the community groups that are engaged with a wide variety of events. If you're just passing through, simply pop along and see what's happening. Lava PS is also renowned for its row of Indian restaurants. Aside from the pushy waiters trying to attract your custom, and the plastic pictures of Vishnu and generic Bollywood dancers, the eateries greatly add to the ambience of the neighborhood. The restaurants look as beaten down as the apartments, but the food is as rich and delightful as the people. If you're lucky, your visit will coincide with the famous Tapa Pies festival. A tapa, of course, is a morsel of food given with a drink, a complimentary extra, a gift from the city. Trevor Noah knows about it. His city was peppered with different pockets of people, all seemingly in opposition to one another, with invisible lines, unspoken rules, and hard, unmistakable consequences. There's always a KFC, he says. There's always that guy. Populating our space is a character, and only you know if that means good or ill. We walk and there's a corner for the smell, rising with the wind and expanding with our nostrils, where scents are the invisible inhabitants of the neighbourhood. And the shop with the best and worst of something, the nicest meat, the meanest bastard. He tells us about the block parties and the mobility of the beat. The richer part hears the rhythm and wants a taste, a slice of the poorer relation. We melt into one another easily, through bus routes and the lack of any meaningful barrier to car or pedestrian, save for a quick scan of an unknown face. Money changes hands, shoulders shrug at petty criminality, and there's always the law of the land and the law of the street. All that is certain is that it will reinvent itself as a hub for electronics, furniture stores, or shops where books search for a second chance. And so the barrio exists, the sum of everything and everyone, the building block for the bigger question of identity. After all, as Frank Costello says in The Departed, aren't we all just products of our environment?
He's sitting in the narrowness of the boat, only the horizon ahead. The quietness of darkness turns it all into a surreal landscape. The last few days are all a blur. A blur that extends its colors into the present moment like a painful paintbrush. And then they all turn black. Ironically, safety is this, unknown waters, lit by a moon which does not seem to be the same one that watches over roof terraces in summer nights. Unknown creatures, both on and under the boat, the souls of those that have tried and not succeeded, sharing that moonlight in silence with him. He's sitting in the narrowness of the boat, only the horizon ahead. The birds chirp on the canopies, peppering the branches with estrident colours, a well-known landscape. The landscape of our forefathers, the landscape of our children. We know the limits of the river, they know us. To the left, three or four prayers into the journey, the crocodile rests. Two or three silences ahead lies, buried in the riverbed, the deepest souls of our ancestors. The river mist lifts over us, protects us, sends our whispers to them, and brings back their blessings. The first few lines are inspired by Edwidge Dante Katz's writing Children of the Sea, included in the Penguin Book of Migration, letters are exchanged after fleeing Haiti between a man and his love, letters that will never reach their recipients, that will be lost in the ocean and will not make it to see the safety of the land, like so many other souls that venture the sea. They are there to bear witness to their feelings, their fears and their tragic destinies. Not just to tell one another, but also to tell us, mere spectators, about a hostile landscape that it is, both safety from the past and a trap into the unknown, unity with those that share a faith and separation from loved ones, from that which is known and familiar to us, that which was there before, that which might not be there after, or which we might not ever get to see again. Certainly not with the same eyes and the same heart. The second segment is inspired by a Patagonia exhibition in Museo Nacional de Antropología in Madrid. Estrecho de Magallanes, La Frontera del Agua, The Water Frontier, a 2020 exhibition, explore the meanings behind water around Tierra del Fuego. These places underpin those people's understandings of life and space. They constitute their very own world, both content and limits. But there is another way in which water defines what is home and what isn't. To use the words of the Colectivo Última Esperanza in the 2021 Hidropoéticas exhibition, a sample of which can be seen in Casa de América, Madrid, water is what defines territories, as everything that is not water. And in that open space, we know that we have abandoned the safety of our land, headed for another place, one equally defined by the water that separates us from it. The extracts in the Penguin Book of Migration speak of departures, arrivals, generations and returns. And of course, not all of the trips are helped by the movement of water. But upon arrival, places are equally less bright and shabbier than we imagined, like a faded version of the photograph our heart had sent to our mind. And the place picks some things from our life that we had long forgotten, and it puts them right back in front of our faces in a way that we cannot escape. And the place invents things that we did not know about ourselves and gives them to us as it deformed the skin we had always lived in. And the place takes hold of our soul and plays with it. The trip in itself would become another place. As Julio Tsuka repeats, on the boat we were, on the boat, highlighting that the choices we made put us in this very place and no other, put us on a journey of no return, one that we will go back to time and time again upon whenever we try to find ourselves. This collective we is masterfully used by Otsuka in her writing Come Japanese. By using that pronoun in short sentences that contradict each other, she highlights the different motives that prompt migration, and how, to those who look at the phenomenon from the comfort that offers an absence of displacement, everybody that flees on the same boat can literally be put on the same boat when it comes to defining them as humans. It doesn't matter if you have five sisters or if your father died when you were a child, if you hate talking to others or if being squeezed next to so many other strangers is the closest to the warmth of a family you have ever felt in your life. You are the same as everybody else. You are they, and when you look out of the window and it rains again, the place will grab you by the shoulders again and tell you to do your best to be we, but not the we from the boat, the we that blends in and does not look back. Your children might not need that push. They will feel like we, and they will also think of you as they. And when you're old, you will wonder whether you are from here or there or nowhere in between, if indeed you ever had a place to go back to, never mind to call home. You will want to tell everybody about who you are, and you will forget about lessons and tell your life story and how you barely knew your father, like the Nao Mengistu in An Honest Exit. And something that had never meant much to you, or that you had escaped from, will suddenly give meaning and place to you. And at the same time, you will end up hanging that other you up at the back of the wardrobe, because you know you cannot afford wearing your summer clothes all year around, let alone in winter. Departures, arrivals, generations. We will make that journey, and we will take with us the children we won't have and the children we will, and they will tell the children in turn, or never speak about us again and look us into a photograph that someone will wonder about one day. We will be we and they and many yous that we learn to live with each other, because that is just the way of the world, and the journey is as long as life and beyond.
migration to other landscapes. The Treasure of the Spanish Civil War by Serge Pey is a short book, but each story is rooted in the soil of Spain and France. In one of these stories, the legacy of the Spanish Civil War and of refugees and their lives as refugees is buried literally deep underground. We think we know where and what it is, but it remains elusive, and the earth, like time itself, shifts and distorts, and we are left with a feeling that seems real enough, and often that is good enough. Other times we see signs of things that have passed, from people who relive the war in their minds, or the signs of hiding men as they emerge and resubmerge, who pass like animals. Only the keenest or most fearful of eyes notice the quivering branch and the disrupted grass. Migration in this book is two things, and perhaps even more than that. Human migration, when compared to that of animals, seems like the strangest of things. Where birds fly here and there for food and warmth, humans flee for their lives, which is a natural impulse. But in this book, these tales of migration are interrupted. In one particular story, Cherry Thief, the dead are living things again, where a survivor of the Civil War names his cherry trees after fallen comrades. But his trees, they are stuck under an impassive sky, the realm inhabited by the aforementioned birds, a creature described by the American writer Jonathan Franzen as beguiling because of their inherent aloofness. They live above us. They do not concern themselves with us, and they dart in and out of our world. Thus, the sky bears down on all the characters, especially upon those migrants who have been stopped and housed in brutal refugee camps. Here, nature is insulted by inhumanity. And in one story, our main character is forced to make a decision between hurting his friend or killing his dog. Thus, there's a rupture, and the antagonists of the story try to harden our hearts to the natural world, so that they can later demolish our natural feelings of kinship with others. From these poisonous seeds spring torture, murder, and pain. In this world, you play dead to stay alive. Or as we see in The Scarab's Revenge, you can weaponize nature to kill your enemies and to avenge all wrongs. We have an intractable relationship with our surroundings. And not for nothing do we see in a story titled The Movies, people enjoying an outdoor cinema, sitting amongst the bushes, watching Tarzan and Jane swing through the jungle, the cradle of what was and what forever shall be, and the backdrop to a catalogue of human atrocities, is nature. Fortunately, beauty runs through this book like a river, and many of our protagonists are in tune with the natural world and charmed by its infinite purity and its inaccessible mystery. In The Washing and Clothesline, humans and Republicans overlay the earth with clothes and secret signals, nourishing it with sound and the sound of underground communication. While in La Sega, an old blind woman moves around the house following the warm rays of the sun. Her door to the outside world is open, and she shadows the movement of our biggest star. And she speaks in rough, unknown tongues. Such is its enigmatic, animalistic quality. Her grandson tries to eat dog meat so he can absorb it into his being, so that he could, in the words of the story, mumble words only ghosts and angels understand. Through the secret language, the boy learned of quivering logics of dust and about butterflies lashed by the salty spittle of horses. So it's not solely about place, but also time. The old lady wears two broken watches, but she instinctively knows when it is time. Time for what? We do not know. And though she wonders why the boy wants to hear the old songs, she sings them anyway. And the village locals fear her because she knows the old ways. The past is a common thread that connects us all, but we resent those that pull at it. Is there a point in nature? It exists, and symbiotically at that. And that in itself imbues it all the way deeper, indefinable meaning. We see this in a tenth story, Chess and Beauty. Two chess masters are imprisoned, and they impress the whole prison with their nocturnal games of chess, which are played out through tapping on pipes. Wrapped, the other inmates dare not make a sound for fear of breaking the magic. Eventually, the two men grow bored of winning and purposefully lose, much to the derision of all those around them. What the mockers and scorners do not know is that the masters are making pretty patterns, retelling great novels or creating wonderful abstractions with their pieces. Their goal is beauty. Nothing more, nothing less. This is a book about war, repression, brutality, concentration camps, and death. Like all human stories, it vibrates with something elemental that at once tells us about the daily realities of all these things and something deeper. Like people, it can be playful, obtuse, and contradictory. And even contradicts the quote from Horace that opens the book. Pay disagrees with the Roman poet by building a world where there is senselessness in a search for meaning, and lands with porous boundaries, wet with muddy ideas of right and wrong.
So that was the first episode of our new format for the podcast. We hope you liked it. And in the future, we'll be making use of all the books that we read and the exhibitions that we go and see, just as we used to do, but telling you something about a theme that we're interested about, like this first one, which was migration, that is very relevant at the moment, just as it always is. So tune in for our next episode. It will be either focused on animal transformation or flying, but we're not going to tell you which one it is yet. So you'll have to find out. So this is Mary saying bye.
Indy saying good luck.